You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Well, welcome, everybody. I've been really looking forward to this. It's going to be, a fun discussion with my friend Marvin on his really terrific new book, which I got to read this past week, The Year I Was Peter the Great. And this book works at many levels, at least it did for me. It's just a wonderful read to begin with. But first of all, it's amazing history, the best kind of history that journalists do the first draft, about a pivotal year in world history, 1956, which when people say 1956, you know, we usually just say Hungary. But we forget that 1956 was triggered by what was going on actually in Russia with Khrushchev, who, when he saw this tall drink of a man for the first time, said he reminded him of Peter the Great, hence the title. But for me as a journalist and a longtime foreign correspondent, the book is also just a reminder of, for me, the best kind of foreign reporting and the best kind of foreign reporters who don't just plunk down somewhere, but are true area specialists. Marvin studied Russian at college and in graduate school at Harvard, and really brought to his reporting a deep insight. And last of all, it's a story of ambition of a young man who grew up in a poor immigrant family, gets into a city university, and aspires to be a writer. And that's why my favorite graph, Martin, in the book is... because I had a teacher just like this who got me into journalism. Marvin tells this story. I marked it, and then I bear with me just for 1 second, because I insist on reading this. So Marvin, I had a journalism professor and teacher in high school in 10th grade who changed my life. She was that teacher. Her name was Hattie Steinberg. And to this day, her journalism class is the only course I've ever taken in journalism at room 313 at St. Louis Park High School. And not because I was that good, but because she was that good. And Marvin had a similar teacher. Yeah, he wasn't as kind as Hattie was to me.
He was not at all.
he was actually a literature teacher. And Marvin tells this story of having had to submit a story, a writing example for the class. And I just want to read this page, Marvin, before we get into it. Because he was asked, you know, to stand up by Professor Goodman. I felt a rush of pride. Goodman walked slowly from the rear of the room to the front. For a few moments, that seemed like an eternity. He looked at me and then asked for my paper, which, of course, I handed to him. Goodman examined the front page, still not saying a word. There was a strange look in his eyes. Was he going to echo the student compliments, or was he going to cut loose with one of his characteristic condemnations? The silence lingered for a few moments. Then, with a dramatic flourish, he held the paper aloft and proclaimed, "Kalb, this is a great story." He paused. I smiled foolishly. "A great story," he continued, "for the waste paper basket." And in one swift motion, he hurled the paper toward the basket, most of it going in, some pages ending up on the floor. Goodman stared up at me, a weird grin on his face. A gasp of incredulity rose from the students. I stood before him and the students for only a second, then burst into tears and fled from the room, pausing only to pick up my briefcase. From the hallway, I heard Goodman shouting after me, "Kalb," he screamed, "all you will ever be in life is a journalist." That's so good, Marvin. That's so good. So, Marvin, start out. Let's begin. Why did you want to write this book now? You waited a long time to write this book, yet it was where you got your start. Tell me, what was the idea about writing it now?
Well, I think you get to a certain time in your life when family first and then friends and then ultimately your grandchildren press you to write down all of the things that you've been telling us at the dinner table. And I resisted for a long time, and I didn't think that journalists are supposed to write memoirs anyway. And then I ultimately yielded when my grandson and granddaughter decided to put just a little bit of pressure on me, and they know exactly how to get to me. And the minute they began to suggest why not, I folded. The only reservation I had was that this was not to be a personal memoir.
Right.
This was to be a professional memoir. It's supposed to be what it is that I experienced as a reporter. And actually, the book focuses on the early time in my life, the training, but then that 1 year in Russia, which was so incredibly special.
So set it up a little for the audience, because for people who haven't read it, just quickly, your education and how you ended up playing Peter the Great in Moscow in 1956.
Well,
and then we'll talk about the importance of 56.
Okay. What happened was that I was doing graduate work. I was probably going to go on for a PhD in Russian history. I was very interested in the subject. My dear brother, who was sitting right back there, Bernard Kalb, he was the one who put the thought in my mind that I really ought to study Russian, the language. I was already interested in the country. And the two came together, and through the last year or so of college and the first 2 years of graduate work, and I was very lucky. Harvard at that time had a Russian research center, and it was loaded with some of the best professors on every aspect
amazing
of Soviet
names,
life.
Amazing names, Marshall Schulman, Pipes, I mean, they were
Alex
amazing.
Alex Inglis, all of these great guys. And I really felt after 2 years that I was well-trained. And I was one of those people who were becoming what they called Russia specialists in those days. Some of the people in the audience will remember that those were the times when people said, know your enemy. And the enemy in those years was clearly the Soviet Union. And I went into the Army then for a couple of years. I was in Army intelligence working on the Korea problem, of all things. And then I went back and was doing my graduate work, and then I was determined to go on for my PhD. And then I got a call from Marshall Schulman, who was the deputy director of the Russian Research Center, and he said, there's an opportunity to go to Moscow, and but we've got to have somebody who speaks the language, knows about the country, has a top secret clearance and can leave in a week. And I said, you know, I'm ready to go. And I did leave in a week. There was a wonderful session, if you'll give me a little more time.
Absolutely, you have all the time you want. And, but your mother wasn't so keen on this.
Well, no, my mother was very hesitant and cautious. But my father, with his great sense of curiosity and adventure, he said, go for it. And I was going to go anyway, actually. And I was so absorbed with the idea of being in Russia. It was a tremendous thing. When you study it at a university, it's all academic. And until you get there, and until you talk to Russians, and until you begin to feel what they feel, you're not really absorbing the essence of the country, which you know yourself from your Middle East days.
If you don't go, you don't know.
You don't go, you don't know. And I went very quickly in any case. On the way there, I had to stop at the State Department, and there was a guy named Bob who gave me a security clearance. And no,
this is a great scene in the book.
Yeah. It was a very interesting clearance. I mean, he came in, and I went to his office. Said he wouldn't look up at me, really. He kept writing or looking at papers. And then finally, he looked up at me, and he said, single, huh? Yes.
You know where this is going to go.
Like girls? Mm-hmm. And then I began to feel uncomfortable because what has that got to do with going? And he said, the ballet. Do you like the ballet? I said, yes, I love the ballet. I intend to go to the Bolshoi as often as I can. And he said, that's the problem. He says, they generally use ballerinas. Use ballerinas. And then he said, you know, knock at the door and sort of seduction. And you got to be very careful because those pictures can embarrass your family, embarrass your country. And I have to admit that at that time, two thoughts were running through my mind. One, he was absolutely right. Two, ballerina.
That's right. It's so bad. I mean,
come on.
Bolshoi.
Anyway, there I went. The first day I was 42 below zero. I went down to Red Square, and I noticed that there was a guy following me. Turned out to be a very young KGB fellow. And I figured that if somebody likes ice cream, he can't be too bad. So I went into the gum department store, and there was an ice cream stand there. And I bought two ice cream cones. And I just gave him one. And he took it.
Yeah.
He took it. He began to lick. I began to lick. I thought it was wonderful. We were off and running. 3 weeks later, Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, delivered a remarkable speech, February 25th, 1956. He brought together about 1,400 big shots and for 4 hours told them how horrible Joe Stalin was, that he was a criminal, he was a murderer. He was so bad that he almost lost the Soviet Union to the Nazis during World War II. He killed 90% of the officer corps of the Red Army. He was a disaster.
Before World War II.
In 1939, 1940. Yeah. He was a disaster. And what we learned later, there were no foreigners in this room, but what we learned later was that so many of these people were Stalin's people. And if Stalin was to be attacked, they become suddenly very vulnerable themselves. And some of them, we learned later, died of a heart attack right on the spot. Many people were seen popping nitroglycerin tablets. A number of them committed suicide when they went back to their hotel room. There was a terrible shock, but when the word got out, slowly but definitely, that Stalin was being attacked by Nikita Khrushchev, the way the Russian people translated that was this terrible fear that we live with. So a heavy Russian overcoat of fear, 3 o'clock in the morning, knock at the door, being hauled off without explanation and simply killed. That is now over. And if it was over, they began to think also, Tom, that they were able to begin to think for themselves, just a little bit, not too much.
But what seems to do that the then first filters Eastern Europe as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It was the first whiff of freedom that they had. And the people in Eastern Europe picked it up. In June in Poznan, Poland, there was an uprising. And the Red Army was called in and crushed it. Czechoslovakia followed. It wasn't too bad in Czechoslovakia. The students kind of shut the country down. But the army did not go in and kill people. But in Hungary, in October and November, the Hungarians took Khrushchev literally, that if we were to have our individual freedom, that is what we want. We want it all the way. We want political freedom. We want the idea of having two parties. We wanted the idea of a free press. They raised that very, very specifically. And Khrushchev then had the first of two fundamentally important decisions he had to make. The second was the Cuban Missile Crisis and to pull the missiles out. The first one was, what does he do with Hungary? He could have allowed the Hungarians to do their thing. But think about that. That would have meant that the Hungarians went independent. They broke out of the Warsaw Pact. If they had done that within a matter of a month, if less, the Poles would have done it. If the Poles had done it, then the Bulgarians would have done it, and then the Romanians would have done it, and the whole East European Empire would have fallen apart. If it had fallen apart, one of Khrushchev's concerns was that if that fell apart, the West would take advantage of our weakness and they would make moves against us. We would have to stop them. There could be a collision of East-West and a nuclear war. And he didn't want that.
But it's an amazing straddle because he's taking the lid off here and screwing it on tighter over here all at the same time.
What he tried to do then was both. And what he had to do at the end of the day on November 6th, I believe, was he sent the Red Army in. And they crushed the Hungarian Revolution in a brutal way. And the Hungarians lost many, many people, and the Russians lost many people too. But that was never advertised to the Russian people. But when Khrushchev made that decision, he saved his job, but he profoundly disappointed the Russian people. Mm-hmm. And in December, at a reception, Khrushchev was always going to receptions. I'll tell that story about Peter.
Yes.
He was always going to receptions, and in December, what he said was, Stalin, no one, I forgot the exact words, but the idea was that when we write the history of the Soviet Union, the name of Stalin will remain great. When we talk about Leninism, we will talk about Stalinism. And he suddenly took that whole wonderful whiff of freedom. He didn't totally crush it, but he sort of stuffed it back into a box. And the Russian people knew very, very well that things were going to get sort of nasty once again, and of course they did.
So you're a young diplomat in Moscow, quasi-diplomat, at least you had a diplomatic passport. The American ambassador, Chip Boland,
yes,
is having a 4th of July reception.
Ah, yes.
And who shows up but?
Nikita
Khrushchev.
What happened is Khrushchev kept going to these parties, and we wondered at the embassy whether he would come to the American National Day reception. And on July 3rd, the ambassador got word from the foreign ministry that Khrushchev and his entire Politburo was going to come to pay their respects on the July 4th holiday.
Including and Marshal
Zhukov, the Marshal of the Minister of Defense. So Ambassador Boland had three other people at the embassy, which was woefully understaffed, who spoke Russian, and each one of us got a member of the Politburo to look after, and mine was Marshal Zhukov. Marshal Zhukov was about 5'5" in height and width, and I was 6'3".
And how old was Marvin Kelb at the time?
26. And so I'm to look after Marshal Zhukov. I was a PFC in the United States Army. And the idea of me looking after a marshal in the Red Army was absurd. But I did it. I planned for it. I made a little speech when we were introduced. And then I took him in the back, and we had a marvelous 40-minute conversation.
But you also had a drinking problem.
We had this wonderful conversation. And in the read that I gave on Zhukov, I found out this guy really liked his vodka. And I didn't drink. So to avoid the start of World War III, I had to find a way of giving him vodka and giving me water. And I enlisted the help of Tang, who was a Chinese-born butler who worked for the ambassador. Who worked for the ambassador, and I went to see him and I said, Tang, we got a big problem. The marshal likes vodka, I drink water, how do we work it out? And he came up with a marvelous tray that was sort of around like this and in, and he would hold it this way. And when he came over to Marshal Zhukov or to me, on this rim was the vodka, and on this rim was the water. Mm-hmm. So that was the way he served, vodka to the marshal, water to me, and he had 8 vodkas, belted back like that. Dodna, wait, right back. And I had 8 waters. And Khrushchev then signaled that he wanted us to leave. And so the two of us walked over, and Marshal Zhukov was a bit tipsy. And I noticed that, and I stepped back for a minute. And he said, to Khrushchev's Nikita Sergeyevich. He said, I have finally found a young American who can drink like a Russian. Khrushchev thought that was very, very funny. He began to laugh. The whole Politburo laughed. And then he began to call me Peter the Great because he asked me, how tall are you? I said, I'm 6 centimeters shorter than Peter the Great. He loved that line. And he began to call me that on a regular basis whenever he saw me. Even, Tom, years later when I went back for CBS, he would sort of spot me. I remember on one trip that Khrushchev made to Hungary, to Austria. And we were in Vienna, and he would not allow the reporters to get near him. But he saw me, and he said, what idiot, Pyotr Veliki. And so I was allowed in. And do you remember the story about Khrushchev boasting after the U-2 spy plane was shot down? It was shot down at 52,000 feet. And he called me over and said at one point, there was one other reporter too, a UPI reporter, and he said, we now have a missile that can shoot a fly in the sky at 60,000 feet. I got shoot and the fly in the sky, but I wasn't sure about the fly in the sky because it was a very special expression. And he could see that in my face. So he called over an interpreter. He said, make sure that he understands what I'm saying. I can shoot down anything up to 60,000 feet. We've got that kind of missile. That was a big story.
Yeah.
It was a big story. And I love the idea of being Peter the Great. What the hell?
So, Marvin, one of the things, it comes up throughout the book, you were keeping a journal, which obviously you were able to draw on for...
I was keeping a journal. It was a terrible journal. I was sort of scraps of paper, but I definitely kept it. And in the writing of this book, it was incredibly helpful to me.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Because I knew what day things happened. Right. I knew, for example, if I had a really interesting conversation with somebody, I would write it down at night, as best I remembered it. And so when it came to writing the Peter the Great book, I was able to be absolutely sure about what was said to me at certain times, where I was.
Yeah.
And I traveled all over the country.
I just want to stay in sequence for a second. Before we go to the travel part, I want to, because the reporter in me just loved this scene. It's how you begin, because word gets out about Khrushchev's speech, and it starts to radiate out.
Oh, yes.
And you describe how different people are putting different pieces together. But then you're off doing your research about this Ukrainian, you find yourself in the library one day, and a little bit of history gets made.
It was a wonderful experience, and it happened several times. I was doing research on a man named Sergei Semyonovich Uvarov, who was a minister of education under Nicholas I in the middle part of the 19th century. Bear with me. And what I was trying to do was to get into the Lenin Library to do research. And two or three nights a week, when I was finished with work, I would go down to the library and really try to get in. And it was an effort. And they kept turning me away. No foreigner was allowed into the Lenin Library. And I kept trying to make as many friends as I could with the librarians. And there was finally one woman who was sort of kinder than the others, and she allowed me to get in. And then once I was in, the question became, what would she give me to use? And she began to give me secondary sources. And I explained to her that for a PhD at Harvard, I needed primary sources. And, well, she wouldn't go that far. But she did begin to give me material. I was sitting in the Lenin Library, which the reading room is about the size of a football field, an immense library with a lot of rectangular tables. And everything is very periodically, everything is very orderly and structured. And there were police around, but they never interfere. And these kids were serious about their work. And I was writing down my Uvarov information when I began to hear young Russians stand up and begin to denounce communism.
This is in the Lenin Library.
In the Lenin Library. I was astonished. But I did not even raise my head. I kept my head down and just began to write everything that I heard. And they were denouncing communism, Stalinism, which was okay then, but also Khrushchev, and also the corruption and the miserable living conditions. And they were just letting it out. And then other young people stood up, and then the whole place stood up. And then they got on top of the tables and began very demonstrably to rip up copies of Pravda and throw it down on the floor. I was watching a student rebellion, and it was a remarkable sight. And I tried to stay as close to the bottom of it all as possible, writing it all down. And at 10 o'clock, the library was shut down, and I thought, wrongly, that all of these kids would pick themselves up, then go down into the street and go to Red Square and do something. But they didn't. They simply vanished. And I was very surprised about that, and I was sort of standing there saying, what the heck do I do with this information?
So what did you do?
I walked as fast as I could to Spasso House, which is the home of the American ambassador. And because I had a diplomatic passport, I showed that to the Russian guard. That was no problem. He let me right through. And then the Marines were standing back there, but that was no problem either, because I lived in the same house called America House on the alongside the Moscow River.
And the Marine recognized
you.
So
they recognized me. I was able to get into Spasso House. I said, could I please speak to the ambassador? If I were a real Foreign Service officer, as some of you in this room may know, that is not the right thing to do. You don't wake up the ambassador.
How old were you? You're 25 still.
Yeah. I figured, what the heck. I had this material that I thought was so fabulous and so interesting. And I woke him up. He came down. He could not have been nicer. As polite, wonderful, as he always was. And he kept taking notes. And then suddenly he stopped and he said, we got to go to the embassy immediately. And he called a car and we whisked off. And he then wrote about a 20-page long cable, which went to the State Department, but was the first eyewitness reporting that the department had on how deeply and profoundly the Khrushchev speech began to affect the people. Yeah. And that, Tom, one, if you went to Gorky Park and began, as I did very often, and you talk to people there, mostly young people, they were expressing their frustration with the system, but also their desire to learn. They realized, I don't know how, but they realized that they were so far behind.
Yeah.
There was so much for them to pick up, and they were smart, they were literate, their grandparents were illiterate. But they were not. They were literate, and a lot of them were first-class scientists, first-class minds, and they knew they were being shortchanged profoundly. And they wanted change. One young Russian said to me at one point, he walked around in the rain for hours, and he looked at me at the end of it, and he said, if I thought it would do any good, if we thought it would do any good, we would all go down to Red Square now and start a revolution. But what good would it do? Nothing. They could crush us immediately. And that is true. And that's pretty much true with Putin now, too.
So what happened? So what did Ambassador Boland do with your little vignette?
What he did was he wrote this long cable, sent it off to the department. The department was very happy to get it. And then Boland, I'm not quite sure how to read it, but he treated me very, very well. He was extremely kind to me. But I was doing something for him also. The embassy, as I said, was woefully understaffed, and In 1956, for the first time since the late 1930s, sections of the Soviet Union were being opened up to foreigners. And I wanted very much to go to Kiev, where my mother was born. I wanted to see that. And I also wanted to get into Central Asia. I was fascinated with Genghis Khan, and I was determined to get there. And they were just opening up, and Boland could allow me to satisfy my curiosity and to go there. And so I did, and I traveled by myself. I undoubtedly was followed at all times, but I really didn't give a hoot, because there was nothing that I was doing that was wrong. I was looking, I was talking to people, and I was learning a lot, but most of it was here. I didn't write anything down. If I had written stuff down there, it would have all been picked up and used as proof that I was some kind of a spy.
Marvin, this little scene you described, though, it winds its way from Chip Boland through the State Department over to the CIA, and then comes out one day.
Thank you. In early June of 1956, I began to read in the New York Times first a full copy of the secret Khrushchev speech denouncing Stalin. That speech fell into the hands of the CIA as a result of the Israelis picking it up in Warsaw, Poland. The Israelis got it from the Poles, gave it to the Americans. The Americans held it then for 3 months, and then decided in June to release it. And this was part of an effort to further the thaw in Russia, to keep it all going. And they thought that that was the best way of doing it. And maybe it was, I don't know, that's hard for me to judge, but they were definitely putting it out. And they also put out the story about how young Russians were in verbal rebellion against the Soviet system. And I read that with a big grin on my face, mm-hmm. because I knew that I was the source on that bit of information. And it was really important, because it was proof that the system was in turmoil, and you only had to be there with minimal sensitivity to pick up the rhythms and talk to the Russians and hear what they've got to say. And one of the things that used to be so remarkable to me was how few people did that. Yeah. That the embassy people, I guess because there were so few of them, they had responsibility at the embassy and they had to do it. But as the kid, I had no responsibility. Yeah. I had to take care of the translations of the press in the morning, but then I was on my own. And if you were responsible, if you were aware that you were not there to cause a problem, but if you were responsible, you could learn an enormous amount. And Marvin, it's one of the things that I picked up later as a reporter. If you are somewhere, let them talk to you, and you will learn so much, even in a closed-up society.
There's a song by rock group Neon Trees that has always been one of my favorite songs and mottos as a journalist. And the main refrain is, everybody talks.
Okay? Everybody talks.
And what you find, even when you go to a closed society, they know who's stealing. Yes. They know who's up. They know who's down. It can be the most closed society. But the maid tells the doorman, tells the butler, tells the professor. And at the end of the day, everybody talks.
Everyone talks. And it's the Russians also have a very special grapevine. Because when they read the Russian, well, in the old days, when they read the Russian, and I think now too, when they read the Russian press, they know what is baloney and they know what is true. Because they live it, they see it, they experience it every day. And in those days, even more so. And there'd be the usual way in which you would read what they call a leader piece, their lead editorial. And the first three columns was drivel, absolutely nothing. And then there'd be the word однако, which sort of means however. or hold on a second. And then if you read it carefully, it was remarkably revealing. You would find stories about the beginning of a political disagreement with the party phrased in such ways as former members of the Communist Party expressing ideas which they probably picked up in the capitalist West were saying this, that, and the other. And then you would say, why are they saying that? They're saying that because they're having an internal argument. And there was a woman whom I deal with in the book as well named Anna Holcroft, who was my boss at the translation service called the Joint Press Reading Service. And Anna Holcroft had been working in and out of Moscow since 1922. There was nothing that the Russians could say to deceive her or to fool her. She could see right through them. And she taught us how to read the press, how to listen to Russian speech, how to figure out what was meaningful and, you know, what you could just get rid of very quickly.
I love that.
I learned enormous amounts from her.
She I love that wonderful. Description that the editorials in Pravda, you know, the first three were unadulterated propaganda, and then the more you read down, the next six revealed the truth. And as I read that, I was thinking, that's six more paragraphs than you get from Fox News today. you know, we're just stuck with the first three. Oh, did I say that? I'm so sorry. Marvin, what do we learn about Russia today from this book? What would someone who's thinking and studying and trying to understand Putin's Russia learn from reading this book about Russia today?
In 1956, the Russian people got, I use the word, the first whiff of freedom. Not in the way in which we understand it, but in the way in which they understood it. And they understood it as a way of being released from fear. Whatever the opposite of fear was, may not have been freedom, but it was for them a real freedom. When they didn't have to worry about being awakened in the middle of the night, when their children were not squealing on them. It was a terrible, it was a dreadful society. It's a dreadful political system. And they finally had the feeling that they were moving toward maybe some romantic vision of communism, but I don't think so. They were moving away from communism and towards something that they read about or heard about what's going on in the West. They were fascinated by the West. In the middle of the night, they would listen to the Voice of America, which very wisely wouldn't load them with propaganda at all. They played jazz. Mm. Mm. They played jazz, and then they did biographies of jazz musicians and songwriters, very smart stuff. And that was in the middle of the night, and they felt very good about that, connection to today. The thing that Putin does today with freedom is he allows freedom that does not damage his control of the system. In other words, some people are allowed to travel. And by the way, not all people. There used to be several years ago that in Russia, all people could travel. That's not the case anymore. Most people can't. Some do. At home, say whatever you like. Don't go out into the street. Do not organize. Do not say anything against Putin in the street, because if you do, you're going to be arrested. And once you're arrested, who knows what's going to happen to you. In other words, he allows a little bit of what Khrushchev allowed in 1956. Gorbachev, when he came along in the mid-1980s, he was what they called a child of the 60s. What that meant, that expression, meant that he was one of those who arose in the Khrushchev era.
Yeah.
Khrushchev inspired people like Gorbachev. Gorbachev could then try to introduce freedom, introduce a kind of socialist democracy in the late 1980s, but he failed. He failed, and of course Yeltsin failed. And the one who came in who was able to do two things. He was able to reestablish control over a country that was falling apart. And the Russian people liked that. They liked the idea of feeling once again that they were powerful. The other thing that he was able to do was to contain this ambition for personal liberty. And right now, Tom, you have two schools of thought on modern-day Russia. And I was just up at the Shorenstein Center at Harvard just a couple of days this week, and we were talking about this, and it broke down into two large groups. There's one group of optimists, I'm one of them, who believes that in 20 years, 30 years, at some point in the not-too-distant future, the Russian people are going to emerge out of the world in which they live today. And then there are the other people who are the pessimists who believe that the Russians simply require a vojd, a very powerful leader who can sit on them and provide them with the leadership that they feel the Russian people require. And there are these two points of view. They're in collision, and the Russian people will ultimately decide which way they want to go. And I think that on the outside, if we, or if anybody in this government figures out that we know what it is that the Russians want, they're going to screw it up. Mm-hmm. And I think we ought to just let them make up their own mind.
Before we go, Tay, we have time for a few questions. Take us to the end of the book, Marvin, because you leverage this whole incredible experience, the year of being Peter the Great, into a job interview with a guy named Morrow.
Yes, I think this is a great story. Bear with me.
I got all the time in the world.
So I finished in Moscow at the end of January in 1957. I went back to Harvard. I was going on for my PhD. I was working very hard at the Lenin Library. And in May, the librarian came over and tapped me on the shoulder. And she said, Marvin, there's a guy on the phone who was asking for you. He says that he's Edwin R. Murrow. I said, hang up on him. Murrow is not calling me, I can assure you of that. Out of the word, not true. And I went back to my work, and she came back later in the afternoon, she said, Marvin, it's the same guy on the phone, and he says he's Edwin R. Murrow. There was something in the back of my mind that Bernie had been in Burma with Murrow, maybe he was, I don't know. I figured I better at least get the phone. So I went over and I picked up the phone. And the minute I heard his voice, I realized what a jackass I had been. I mean, it was Edward R. Murrow without any doubt. And he said, I just read your article in the Times magazine about Soviet youth. Thought it was a marvelous piece. I'd like you to come down and talk to me about it. I said, yes, sir. And when? He said, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, my office in New York. I said, yes, sir, I'll be there. So I ran to my room, got a shirt, got a train, was there way ahead of time. His secretary said, you've got a half hour. Remember that. He's very busy. I said, yes, ma'am. 9 o'clock, he popped out and said, come on in. I went in, sat down, and he began to ask me one question after another about Soviet youth, what they feel, marriage, religion, family life. He wanted to know everything. And then in the middle of it all, he said, how would you like to work for us? He said, yeah, you, how would you like to work for us? I said, I'd be thrilled, be a great honor. And he said, well, let's drink to that. And he reached down into the right-hand drawer of his desk and pulled out a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch. This was about 10:30 in the morning. He had two large glasses and began to pour. And the look on my face must have been one of horror. And he looked at me and he said, oh dear, you don't drink. I said, no, does that mean there's no job? He said, no, but it does make it that much more difficult. And we talked, by the way, for another hour and a half. At 12 o'clock, his secretary came and said, you really, Ed, you've got to be on your way now. And as we walked out, he put his arm around me and he said, "You are now one of us." And I melted right on the spot. And that's the way I joined CBS.
So when I read that story, Marv, we'll go to questions in a second, it brought me back to, I was involved in a somewhat controversial incident as the New York Times bureau chief in Beirut in 1982, when I wrote a story saying Israel had indiscriminately bombed and shelled Beirut on August 12th. And they actually took the word out of my lead, and I was very upset, and I wrote a memo back that got public, and Abe Rosenthal was on vacation, though, when it all happened. And when he came back, I was still in Beirut. He demanded to see the memo that I wrote, which called them gutless cowards. And he did not take...
You wrote that?
I wrote that, actually, in a memo. Abe didn't like that very much, and he'd go into his office, he'd steam about it, and then he'd come back out, and by the end of the day, he'd worked himself up into a fine lather. And it was suggested to me by one of the senior editors at the time that I... it'd be good if I apologized for my career. And so I eventually apologized for my memo getting public. And then he sent me back a very stern, you know, email that said, under the circumstances, your apologies accepted, A.M. Rosenthal. Anyways, the end of the summer came, Arafat left Beirut, I come back to New York, but my career is hanging in the balance. And they asked me to, Abe asked to meet me in a restaurant before I go back into the newspaper, I'm coming back. And we met in the restaurant, we sat down, he said, I just gave you a $5,000 raise. Now tell me what happened. And we had this incredible lunch, I told him the whole story, we were both crying, and at the end of the lunch we got up and we got our jackets on, and he threw his arms around me and he whispered in my ear, "Now listen, you clever little shit. Don't ever do that again." So when I read your story, I just... So the floor is open. We have about 10 minutes, 15 minutes for questions. Please, yeah, identify yourself, and there's the microphone right there.
Hi, my name is Dimitri. Mr. Kalb, thank you very much. Very much looking forward to your book. I thought it was interesting you said that when you mentioned Khrushchev and he feared for the empire in the East, that he'd lose the empire in the East. So I think now it's very, a lot of people talk about Putin resurrecting the Russian empire, and that's kind of the talk about Russian foreign policy. So if you had to look 20 years, not in terms of Russian domestic politics and the liberties there, but in terms of Russian foreign policy, what do you see as the options there? Is it destined to have this empire-like outlook on the world in terms of insecurity and always trying to expand? Just what do you see as the foreign policy? And thank you again for the book.
Thank you, Dimitri. I will...
it's a good question.
...share with you what I think without any assurance that I'm close to the truth. Please understand that. My sense of Putin is not... that he is this great, powerful figure who shows his muscles whenever he has a chance and all of that. I think he's a very frightened man. And I think he's a frightened leader. And one bit of evidence is that last year, 2016, he signed an order setting up a National Guard unit for internal work to be consisted of 350,000 troops. This is in addition to the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, and everything else. These people are now all over the country. They perform the role of the old KGB and the ordinary cop. And if you mess around with the Putin system, they are going to get you. And that suggests to me a man who is living in fear of his own people. And that is why he has taken action in Ukraine. That is why he took action in Crimea. Because he fears popular rebellion more than anything else. That goes back to his time when he was a KGB officer in Dresden, East Germany. And the German people in 1989 stormed his headquarters. He didn't know what to do. He was frightened. He was a colonel, but frightened. And he called his headquarters in Berlin, and there was nobody there to take his call. Got more frightened. Paul Mosca, which you're not supposed to do. And nobody picked up there either. And what he writes later is that he made up his mind at that point that Russia will never again be in a position where it is not firm and strong, and everybody would know that. And that was in his mind when the Ukrainian people rebelled big time in 2014. He knew he had to act. He had made up his mind to act in the beginning of December of 2013. He alerted his army that when he gives the order, they are to move into Crimea and they're to move into the southeast part, Donbas region of Ukraine. He didn't want war, but he wanted an environment in which he could flex his muscles. And if he had his way, and if Trump turned out to be the Trump he thought he was going to get, but did not get, but in that romantic period when he still had illusions of a marvelous honeymoon with Trump, he was thinking about something that I'm simply calling Yalta II. He was thinking about a Russian-American deal that would split up Europe. He didn't need official control of anything. He just needed that region to be free of any threat against Russia. And that was the deal that he had in mind. He doesn't any longer, because he's been very disappointed in Trump, and he thinks Trump it's a fascinating story between the two of them. They are meeting either today or tomorrow. You would think only 6 months ago, if they were about to meet, the headlines would be filled with speculation about what they are going to do and Trump will give this. And no. Now it's a very defensive operation on both sides. They're containing damage. Putin does not want a war, but he wants to live with the feeling of omnipotence, even though he knows it's not real.
Got time for a couple more? Anybody else have a question? All the way back there.
Hi, my name is Valerie.
Can you stand up, please?
Sure. I'm a student at American University, and I was just wondering what advice you would give to future diplomats, people, Russian specialists, as you said, who are going to be going and having conversations like you had in Gorky Park. And how do you think generational differences play into the way that Russians see their leaders?
Wonderful question.
I would do my best to go to Russia. There are opportunities. They are dwindling in number, but they still exist between universities in both countries. They have sister universities. He hasn't shut them all down yet. And I'm quite sure that American University probably has a deal, or at least that's something that you ought to check to find out what the sister university is in Russia. And if you are somebody who is interested in the country and interested in whatever uncomfortable realities you may face, if you're prepared to ride above that and just go there to learn, you will learn a tremendous amount. If you keep your eyes and ears open, you will learn a great deal. And it's not the same as it was. He has cracked down significantly on what foreigners can do, but there's still a lot you can do. Even within the acceptable areas of what you can do, there's a lot. There's a lot of Russian culture that is still open. The Russian people will still talk to you. It's not Stalin now, it's Putin. It's a different kind of autocracy. But it is an autocracy.
Everybody still talks. We have time for one more question up here. And then nobody leaves the building without buying a book.
You're a great storyteller, Mr. Kalb. Why is Putin so popular? What's he doing right? Why is this? Why does he have like an over 80% popularity rating?
Well, let us please remember that the Levada service, which is a Russian service, and which was very good and did come up with terrific information, is now under enormous pressure from the government to contain their research. And the man who put it all together, I'm not sure he's even there now. I think that his deputy has taken over. So I'm only suggesting that what you're reading may not be as authoritative as it was. That's point one. Point two, if you went to a Russian now and said, I'm with Levada, and I would like to know, do you regard Vladimir Putin as a strong leader, a moderately strong leader, a weak leader, a bad leader? What do you think you would say? My guess is you would go with the strong leader because you figure that's what he wants you to say. What I try to remember when a question like this comes up is that it was only 6 years ago that tens of thousands of Russians were on the streets carrying banners saying, "Down with Putin." And that's also in his mind. He is terrified of popular protest. And so I am not at all surprised that he now has 82% approval rating. I'm surprised it's not 92.
Reminds me of a joke they used to say that there was an election in Syria once when Hafez Assad was president, and they came to him with the results, and they said, "Mr. President, you won 99.7% of the vote." It means only 0.3% of Syrians didn't vote for you. Well, what more could you ask for? And he said, "Their names." Marvin, in 1974, I was a junior at Brandeis University, and one day I went into the bookstore, and there was a book there, it was a biography of Henry Kissinger by Marvin and Bernie Kalb. Yep. And I read that book, and I said, "I want to be them." Okay, when I grow up, I want to be a foreign correspondent like them, travel with the Secretary of State and whatnot. It's such a treat and a thrill to be here. I'm so glad Bernie's here too. I cannot recommend this book more. It was a treat. I breezed through it. An honor to be here with you, and you should go from strength to strength. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Now you have to sign mine.